is KABF in Little Rock, 88.3, the voice of the people in Central Arkansas. It's time for Radio Cals, a weekly program from the Central Arkansas Library System. Every Wednesday from 6 to 6:30 p.m. here on KABF 88.3 FM, we'll share with you conversations with interesting Arkansans on primary sources, chewing the fat with Rex and Paul, and much, much more. We invite you to let us know what else you want to hear by contacting us at radiocals@cals.org. This program is presented by the Butler Center for Arkansas Studies and the CALS Communications and Public Relations Department. For more information about Radio CALS, please visit the Butler Center's blog at butlercenter.org. Hello, and welcome to Primary Sources, a featured production of Radio CALS. Here on Primary Sources, we focus on people who are making a difference in Little Rock and Arkansas. Some you might have heard of, and some you haven't heard of, but probably want to know about. Check out cals.org/podcasts for a free podcast of Primary Sources interviews. This week on Primary Sources, we present an interview with Robin Wood Laux, who is a 16-year-old student at Little Rock Central High during the 1957 desegregation crisis. Current students at Central High conducted this interview as part of Central High's Memory Project.
We are with
Robin Laux, and I was a student at Central High School in 1957.
Good to have you here with us today.
I'm delighted to be here.
What is your story?
My story is when Terrence Roberts came into the algebra class that first day with 101 Airborne Division with him, I sat at the back of the room that day for some reason. I always sat at the front of the room close to the teacher's desk because I was so terrified I was going to fail that I didn't want to miss a word.
Yeah.
But that day I sat at the back of the room and he came in and he kind of fell into the seat at the desk right across from me. And I expected that when the teacher said, open your books to page whatever it was, that he didn't have a book. It is, as it turned out, it had been stolen in one of the previous classes. And so there was this interminable silence. And I was waiting for one of the boys in the class to share their book. Because this was 1957, and girls didn't share books with boys. But nobody made a move. And a little voice in me said, get up, move your desk, and share your book. And so I stood up and moved my desk and sat down, and we shared the book.
Were there any, like, negative comments after you've done this action? Like, how did your teachers feel or students in that classroom look at you different?
He had a teacher who could quell you with a look. She did not put up with any nonsense from anyone. So it was a very quiet class. Everybody behaved.
So when you shared your book with Terrence, to this day, do you regret your decision?
Absolutely not.
I like that.
She answered that fast.
Yeah, no hesitation.
Positive.
I like that.
I am remarkably lucky in that I had an incredible mother during World War II. You have to remember, this is 60 years ago this year.
Wow.
That's a long time. I was 16, so I'm now 76. And it was a whole different world back then. After my father was in World War II, and after the war, he was stationed in China. And my mother, at that point, had military travel. So she took us to Peru, and we lived there for a couple of years. And it was a wonderful experience because this was a multicultural country. Lima, Peru is an enormous city. It was then, it is now. You have every color of the human race there. And we traveled all over the country. We went to villages high in the Incas, high in the Andes, where Inca villages still were. My sister and I were very blonde little girls. I was maybe 6 at the time. And we would go through these villages, and the Indians would reach out and touch our golden curls. And my mother would say, it's all right, let them touch it. They've never seen a blonde child before.
Yeah.
Literally. So what I got, and my mother also allowed us, Lima, a huge city, She took us two blocks. She put us on the bus, showed us how to ride the public transportation clear across Lima to go to school. The public buses were filled with people of every color. They were fine. Everything was normal. So we grew up without understanding the Southern prejudice against darker skins. And there's a story that my mother had to tell. When she was 16, she went to Paris with her mother, and they were sitting at a railroad station, a table for four, just the two of them, and a very elegantly dressed black couple came up and asked if they could share the table. And my grandmother said, well, of course. And so they sat down and made pleasant conversation, and it turns out that he was a professor at Howard University. This would have been in the 20s, almost 100 years ago. Mother said at that moment, and she grew up in the Delta, she said, I will never judge another human being on the basis of skin color. This couple was so much better educated, so much more elegant, so much better dressed than they were, that she realized in Paris, again, a city, a huge city of multiculturalism, that you cannot judge somebody on superficials. You just can't do it.
At the, you did share your book with Terrence. How did those around you react to, like, personal family members, teachers, and friendships?
My family was completely supportive. Absolutely. My sister was off at school at that point. So it was just me and my mother. My parents had been divorced. But mother worked at the Arkansas Gazette. She was the food, home, and garden editor. And during the Central crisis, I would go down to the Gazette almost every day after school and do my homework down there. So I got to know most of the people in the newsroom. Because there were news people, newspaper people from all over the world. My mother invited a Swedish journalist to come to dinner, and we were talking about what was happening at school. She asked me if I could get some of the students at school, segregationists and what we called ourselves moderates, and some of the black students to come together to, and I think you've probably studied about that. So I got that together, and we met at a little Catholic chapel, and over the course of several hours, we convinced the segregationists that it was perfectly fine for the black students to want a better education. And they said, the two girls said that they would go home and talk to their parents about it, and of course, by the next day, they had been convinced otherwise. But I was on the student council at that point. I was the 11th grade student council rep, and I begged the president of the student council to have this same conversation enacted on the stage in front of all the students, and they wouldn't let me do it. And I was told by the vice president, the boys' vice principal, that if I continued to try to make waves, that I would be expelled.
How did you feel about that?
You have to understand that this was before the Civil Rights Movement. This was some years before the Civil Rights Movement. This was probably one of the first examples of racism in the United States that had no business happening. And nobody knew how to cope with it. And I was a very well-disciplined young lady. And when the betters of us, the principal, vice principal, and so forth, said this will happen, then I had to back off. But it was not a happy year, I can assure you, that I was followed home from school that first day. I had stones thrown at me. I had words thrown at me. I was spat on. And what I did by the time I got home was just simply turn around and look at them. And they turned around and left, because I can have a pretty quelling look.
Pretty big stare.
Because I knew I was right.
How has your discipline helped you persevere through all of the events that followed after you did that act?
My family always believed in a stiff upper lip. You stand tall, you don't back down.
Were you the only white student that would kind of help out and be a lending hand to the others, to the Little Rock Nine who was there at the time?
No, I am sure that there were others in the various classes.
After this happened, did you have friends that kind of like looked at you different, like you didn't deserve to be with your own race, like they kind of kicked you out of your crew or your group?
Well, I didn't really have a group at that point because they just opened Hall High School, and most of my friends, because you, in the 10th grade, everybody went to Central. In the 11th grade, which was in 1957, they had built Hall High School, and a lot of my friends went there. So I only had a few friends who, because I lived in a different side of town, I went to Central, and the friends that I had were very supportive. They just didn't do anything.
It was just a way of life.
It was something that was a choice that you made, and you did it.
I appreciate you for even saying that, though. Mm-hmm. Like, we need to probably open up to more people to get more like you. Do you believe that more people out should know about your story and what was going on a little deeper in the situation that occurred?
I think that my story is just a tiny little drop in the history of time.
of the Little Rock Nine?
Well, of any historical action, time goes on.
Did they ever ask the students, the Caucasian students at the school, if it was okay with them, if the Little Rock Nine of black kids could come into their school?
I don't think they asked the students, but we all knew integration was going to happen that fall. And as far as I was concerned, everything was hunky-dory. Everything was going to be just fine. It had happened previously. I think it was Greenbrier, Arkansas, was it, that they integrated very peaceably. There should not have been a Little Rock Central High School crisis. That was a political manipulation by Orville Faubus.
And who is that again?
The governor of Arkansas at that time.
Do you know people that's still living today that you went to school with that have that regret on them or that wish that none of this would have ever happened?
Oh, I think a lot of people wish that it would never had happened to begin with. Of the few people, friends that I still have from Central, they all were all for it and were horrified at the reaction.
They were all for
integration. Well, the problem that they have is you have to be taught to hate, and you learn it at home. And the way I was brought up was that you didn't hate, and there are certain fundamental rules and values that our society is supposed to have. Christian values, such as do unto others as you would have others do unto you. American values, such as all men are created equal. All women are created equal as well. Those are the values that I was brought up with. And when the time came, I simply believed they were true. And I still do. It's just that, particularly, in my opinion, with evangelical Christians at this point in time, that they have forgotten those very fundamental values. Love one another. If you love one another, you cannot hate one another. And how simple is that?
Very simple.
Like, you just blew my mind. Like, I'm like this years. I might sound crazy right now, but I love hearing that type of stuff, like, to kind of inspire me to be a better person. And I thank you for doing that for me today.
Well, you're more than welcome.
So are there any other lessons that just any common citizen should learn from your story or from just the situation as
a
whole?
Do unto others as you would have others do unto you. That should be a guiding mannerly thing to do from the day you wake up that morning and all day. I mean, these are very simple principles to live by. What happens when you drop them? Do you get them in grade school anymore? Do you get them in pre-K? Why not?
Is the world today still based on hatred?
It shouldn't be.
That must be.
All of the great religions teach love. All of them.
See, that's another thing. Like in public schools, you're not taught religion in that school.
Well, you shouldn't be taught religion in school. You should be taught religion at home.
And is that a problem sometimes, even that you don't believe that? I'm not saying it, but do you believe that it's a problem in a household first before you even get to the public?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You are supposed to learn your values and your morals and your ethics first at home, then at church if you choose to go to church. And the schooling should emphasize them. They do in other schools all over the world. For instance, in Japan, they don't have custodians at public schools. The kids clean up. They clean up every day after school. Do we do that?
No way.
Do people throw their trash on the ground at school?
All the time.
And don't pick it up?
All the time. I see it all the time.
I know that you mentioned the teaching manners in school.
No, teaching manners at home.
Teaching manners at home and then emphasizing it at school. Because I remember whenever I was in pre-kindergarten at Crystal Hill, mm-hmm. and I remember, like, my teacher, who is Miss Thompson, if you may know her.
I am impressed that you can remember pre-K.
I know. I'm still impressed. I guess it was just like a really, I guess it was just like a good time in my life. Just
no worries.
Being a child. Yeah, just no worries as a child. But I remember like Miss Thompson, a lot of like my morals and my ethics now align with the things that I learned in pre-K.
Well, good.
So it's kind of like disheartening to hear that they don't really emphasize that in schools
well,
much anymore.
Please and thank you both thing too.
Yeah. So you also talked about earlier your experience on the Oprah show. Could you tell us more about that?
That was a quite remarkable event. I got a phone call, a message on my phone that was on a Friday. And it said, if you are the Robin Woods who went to Central High School, would you please call this number? And I thought, oh, right. So I called it back, and they said, do you remember a name of Terrence Roberts? And I said, well, yes, I do. And they said, would you explain what happened? And so I did. And they said, we would like you to be a surprise guest on a show that's going to be taped on Monday. Can you come? And I said, yes. Because I happened to have my own little business, and I could take off. So they flew me up, and they combed my hair and made me up, and out I went. And I almost fell over some TV cables, which would have been a grand entrance if I'd fallen flat on my face. And what it did, it was the first time, that was 96, that was the first time since Central High School that anybody had really asked me about it. And it was very cathartic, I have to say, because for the intervening years, I almost never spoke about it because it was such a terrible year. Because I got hate mail. I got hate phone calls. I had people say unfortunate things to me. And that experience caused for me, as it did for Elizabeth Eckford, post-traumatic stress. But and part of the symptoms of that is that you don't talk about it. You bury it. And having that experience on the Oprah show allowed me to work it through. So I'm really pleased about that.
But also, like you mentioned, that it was kind of like really like damaging to hold that story in. So after you, or like, what advice do you have for people who may be going through the same situation?
You have to talk about it. You have to talk about it and talk about it and get it out.
Earlier, you talked about how you had traveled to Paris and Peru. So do you think that with you traveling, do you think that played a part in...
Huge.
That is my question.
We live in a great, big, wide, wonderful world. People who don't have the opportunity to get out and see it become very narrow because they live within the confines of their own little community and they never broaden their outlook. So travel is incredibly important. So learning another language is incredibly important.
Okay, so you mentioned talking it out at first. How did you know when was the right time to talk about it? How did you?
I didn't. Oprah invited me to talk about it.
Mm-hmm. How did she get in contact with you? Was it from the Little Rock Nine, or did she?
Actually, through the White House. Since I lived in Little Rock, they contacted the White House, and there were staff members who knew who I was.
That's wild. Like that's.
That's when Clinton was president.
Can you tell us about the year the schools closed?
Yes, I got out of Dodge. I moved to New York. I did a semester at UALR because for some peculiar reason, I always took summer school courses. And by the time the year was over, I lacked one credit of English from graduating. So I took the Scholastic Aptitude Test and went on into college. I was just going to do anything to get out of Arkansas.
Okay. So what did you pursue over in New York?
I went to work for NBC.
And what was your position over there?
Oh, I was a guidette.
Could you explain more about what that is?
A guide. Big companies like that, particularly in the television industry, they had guides that would take people all the way through the studios and through the company to explain to the visitors, to the tourists, what was going on. And I was only 17, so I was pretty good at it.
And did that job lead into any other opportunities or spark your interest in doing something else?
Not particularly. what I did was ultimately get married, and far too young.
As today's young youth, do you notice a difference of, like, people in groups? Like, do you notice, like, African-Americans being with their group and Caucasian people being with their group and Hispanics and...
Mm-hmm. Yes, I do see that. And that is human nature to go be with people that you feel comfortable with. And again, travel is a great leveler. You get to learn that we're all the same inside.
What do you feel the cost of segregation has impacted the U.S.?
To a very negative degree, because the way our country was founded with slavery, and the country refusing to get over that, the Jim Crow laws, all of that inequality and ugliness, there have always been people who try to break it out, to teach, to try and get people to realize that we are all the same. If you go down the street and you look very carefully at every human being that you look at, you and you, and you, and you, and you. Look at them very closely. And I can say this because I have a degree in art. And when you draw the human body and you draw the human face, every wrinkle, every aspect is beautiful. And so, whether you like it or not, you're beautiful, and you are beautiful, and you are beautiful, and you are too. So are you. And you cannot ignore that if you wish to be part of the human race.
Oh my God, I just love her. Like, she's like inspiring me. You're like, oh my God.
And we're all part of the human race. I should have brought you a thing that I often do when I speak to students. Have you ever seen a collection of hen's eggs? They come in blue. They come in green. They come in white. They also come in almost a chocolate speckled shells. If you crack them open into a bowl, you cannot tell which was the green one, which was the blue one, which was the white one, which was the chocolate one, or which was the speckled one. You are all alike.
I love how you are so humble. Like, you, the Terrence thing, you just like, that's just the polite way of doing things. You just did it because
it was the right thing to do.
It was the right thing to do. And I just like how you are so humble.
Living in that time, do you see any similarities between kind of like the social standing of that time and now?
It's very similar. It's very similar. There is, and it's certainly being talked about more and more. In contemporary politics, we have the upper 1%, and then you have the lower 1%, and you have all of the middle, and we can't get along. Why can't we get along? And it's a little bit of everybody's responsibility to reach out and get along.
Now, kind of going back to what you were saying, that you did what you did because it was the right thing to do, considering, like, some of the people there, to them, In their eyes and minds, that was the right thing to do. So could you kind of explain the difference of the right and the wrong thing? Because to them, their parents probably told them, go to school and make sure that they never, ever want to come back. And this is never going to happen. We all going to stay segregated forever.
Well, you bring up a very good point. And in my opinion, they didn't learn their morals and their values and their ethics at home. What they learned was a lack, or what they had was a lack of critical thinking at home, because critical thinking gets you to make value judgments based on facts as opposed to emotion. And they were all basing their actions on huge emotion.
Okay, so also in the Oprah segment, I remember she had a quote that said, the root of racism isn't hatred. It's ignorance.
It's ignorance and fear.
It's ignorance and fear. So do you believe that it is possible for somebody to actually just hate one race?
You obviously have seen it. It's alive and well
But we have a huge problem, I think, in our society, and that is the deterioration of our schools. They're not teaching critical thinking anymore, except in George West's classes. They're failing to teach civics. They're failing to teach history, really. And these are subjects that are invaluable to having a civilized democratic society. And when you see people breaking away from that, then it can degenerate into chaos.
You were saying that the world is not coming together. And I was thinking, well, what are some ways where we can all come together as one?
Solutions.
Some solutions.
Again, it always goes back to each individual has to make a determination whether he or she is going to adhere to the values and the ethics that we should be teaching. It's, you cannot make anybody else behave the way you want them to behave. They've got to make the determination that they themselves are going to change. And as beautiful as this world is, and there's so many aspects of it that are so valuable, you look at the chaos in other countries. Look at the pitiful Middle East. Look at what is going on in Africa. It is tragic. Why can't they get along?
It has to do with the ethics and principles.
And religious beliefs. And power. And power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely.
How do you feel the LRSD desegregation case that has lasted for the last few decades demonstrates how the 1957 crisis continues today?
It still continues today because we haven't changed people's minds. In 57, the Little Rock Nine came to Central because they wanted better education. They had some really darn good teachers in the black community. I've met some of them. And they were just as hard-nosed as our white teachers were. They did not accept anything. I mean, you studied. You were there to learn. You were not there to disrupt the class. And that's what we had. So the Little Rock Nine simply wanted a good education. Central, at that point, was one of the top 10 high schools in the country. When they closed the schools, I talked to Terrence. He went to California. He said the schools weren't nearly as good as Central was. And so as it continues, as people don't want to go to school with somebody else because of somebody else is a different skin color than them, then you're going to run into teachers who are prejudiced. And they are going to downgrade some of their black students, because when I was doing student teaching, I saw that, and it really made me mad. And so you have to get over the prejudice, or the teachers have to get over the prejudice, the students have to get over the prejudice. And the sad thing about the lawsuit, and I know John Walker, you can't legislate. The laws may be there, but unless the behavior is there as well, it's going to be a sticky wicket.
And also another hot topic has been, how do you discuss the sometimes even the unconscious biases that you may have against others?
Other people.
Yes. So how do we go about discussing things like that?
Like this, the conversation we're having today, you talk about it.
Right. The truth may hurt, but it's the truth and it needs to be heard, right?
So you have to ask yourself, what kind of biases do you have?
Whoa.
What you do? Everybody has their biases. Simply because you are a unique individual. The way you perceive the world is unique to you. Nobody else perceives it the way you do. Now, let me tell you, as you get older, you should become more humble. If I'm humbled at 76, just what am I going to be at 96?
Past humble.
Everybody should grow. I mean, this is what life is all about. It is a fabulous journey. It really is. You can choose to make it a good one, or you can choose to make it a negative one. Choose a good one.
You've been listening to Primary Sources on Radio CALS, a production of the Central Arkansas Library System, its Arkansas History Department, the Butler Center for Arkansas Studies, and the CALS Communications and Public Relations Department. For more information, please visit cals.org and butlercenter.org. Our producer is Glenn Whaley. Production manager is Shelley Stormo. Voices by Jasmine Job and John Miller. Engineering and editing by Anna Lancaster and Shelley Stormo. Our executive producers are Leanne Blackwell Hoskin and David Strickland.
This is KABF in Little Rock, 88.3, the voice of the people in Central Arkansas.